The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Judge Ross, Judge Smith, the Honorable Matthew E. Johnson presiding.
Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. For the sake of the audio record, I will say that today's date is May 19, 2022. This panel of the court today has six cases on its agenda, three of which will be submitted with oral argument and three of which will be submitted without oral argument solely on the briefs. The first case for oral argument today is number A21-1238, State of Minnesota versus Duke Ogeto Morocco. Counsel for the parties are familiar with our procedures, which are more or less the same on Zoom as they are in a courtroom. Counsel for appellant, you may introduce yourself and your client and proceed.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, Rachel Bond representing the appellant, Duke Morocco. Appellant was convicted after a jury trial of first degree assault and pattern of stalking conduct. And in this direct appeal from the judgment of conviction, we are asking the court to reverse the convictions because the pandemic related delays in bringing the appellant to trial violated his constitutional right to a speedy trial. This court should also reverse the first degree assault conviction because the state's evidence failed to prove great bodily harm, as that term is meant in the first degree assault statute. I hope to spend most of my time this morning on the sufficiency of the evidence issue, but I would, with the court's indulgence, make a few quick points on the speedy trial issue. Obviously, we are all waiting for guidance from the Minnesota Supreme Court on that, and I acknowledge the state of the law. The length of the delay, just to put a number on that, my internet calculator calculates at 204 days, which goes from the September 28th, 2020, final invocation of the right to a speedy trial until the first day of trial on April 20th, 2021. That is obviously a presumptively prejudicial amount of time and a not insignificant length of time in addition.
Second, and Ms. Bond, yes. would you agree? Sometimes I think our way of talking about delay is perhaps imprecise. 60 days would have been, 60 days was his right, or that's what the rule provides. So maybe is it fair to say the delay was 144 days?
That's sort of what I came up with last night. I think that's a fair number to put on it. Yes.
You argue that our court got it wrong, and of course we occasionally do, or at least we're told that we do. But you do argue on the merits why we were wrong, but your brief doesn't argue on the point of stare decisis. I mean, if we were to reverse ourselves, there's a body of case law and some standards that we apply, and I didn't see your brief addressing it. I'm assuming you're sort of punting over our heads on that one, just assuming that you're going to get to the Supreme Court and not really expecting us to reverse ourselves.
I don't particularly expect this court to reverse itself in Jackson. I think the court has already indicated in other non-precedential opinions that it's going to follow Jackson. So I'm a little bit being practical about the fact that I'm preserving this issue pending any further guidance from the Minnesota Supreme Court. But I think that, I don't address stare decisis specifically. I think I do mount an argument that the court's decision in Jackson that this factor is neutral or doesn't count against the state was wrongly decided, and a significant amount of case law, I think it's sort of significant that in other areas such as the First Amendment area, the United States Supreme Court has been very clear that there's not a pandemic exception to constitutional rights, and I think that should be applied in the Sixth Amendment speedy trial context as well.
Let me, before you jump onto the merits, then I do want to touch on something that's just a matter of significant curiosity for me. It seems like the ships are passing in the night when it comes to the issue of whether there's prejudice. You say don't have to show prejudice because it's presumed. The state says you didn't present any evidence of prejudice. And it's odd to me because when you go back to the heart of all of it, the Freiberg decision in the Supreme Court says that indeed prejudice is presumed, But then it goes on to say that because the delay in no way affected the strength of the defendant's case, including prejudice, so it seemed to weigh the factor, even though, what's the state of the law as to how we are to treat prejudice? The parties don't seem to agree.
Well, I think the case law isn't entirely consistent on that. I think the big picture, certainly the Mikkel decision, I think gives some extra instruction that this is a sensitive balancing test of all the factors in general. I think the state of the law is such that prejudice is not required. A defendant's speedy trial rights can be violated in the absence of a concrete showing of prejudice. If there is a concrete showing of prejudice, or even an argument of prejudice, even if it is not concretely proven, I think that affects the balance. I think that means that there is more of an indication in the case that the right has been violated. So my prejudice argument in this case and in every speedy trial case starts with, I don't have to show it. It's presumed. But there's something else that I can talk about, and here's what it is. And in this case, I do think it's significant. I mean, one of the things I was going to touch on was the assertion of the right is very strong. And the assertion of the right, Mikkel tells us and other cases tell us, is a particularly strong evidentiary factor in this analysis because it can reflect the defendant's subjective belief that he is being prejudiced by the delay in bringing him to trial. And for the prejudice component, what I would focus the court in on is the period of time after January 14th, 2021. It is correct, as the state says in its brief, that before that time period, the appellant was in custody on another offense as well. And so that might be a good example of, in this case, how for that pre-January 14th time period, it is harder to show prejudice, but the law doesn't require me to show prejudice. For the post-January 14th, 2021 time period, the situation changes quite significantly because...
Well, before I take you off of this onto the substance of your... the heart of your argument on the merits, because I do want to hear from you on that as well. I'm just, were you able to find anywhere in the country, since the pandemic-related delays have been going on all over, any case anywhere where the, in this case, you've got a three-month delay from January 14th until the trial in April. Were you able to find any case anywhere in the country where a speedy trial argument has led to an overturning of a conviction on 3 months?
Well, I'm going to quibble with the 3 months a little bit because the delay is longer than 3 months. No, I have not, Judge Ross. And I think that the courts have pretty uniformly been rejecting these COVID-related speedy trial claims. I think it's wrong. I think the focus of the courts when they make these decisions is on the administration of justice piece. And this sort of, it was a pandemic, what were we to do? But the Chief Justice can, you know, those orders were valid, they were issued, trials were delayed and stopped, but that doesn't mean that there are not constitutional consequences in a particular individual case to that decision. So I recognize the law is not particularly helpful either in Minnesota or across the nation, but nonetheless, I'm making the claim and asking the court to reverse on the speedy trial basis. Unless there's other questions, if I could move to the sufficiency claim. Obviously, there are multiple parts to the definition of great bodily harm. I think the heart of the issue for this court is the part of the definition that was the state's theory at trial, which is the permanent or protracted loss or impairment of the function of a bodily member. I am going to pause and address the state's new theory on appeal, which is that there was scarring sufficient to affirm the first degree assault conviction based on a serious permanent disfigurement.
Just so we're clear, does the instructions to the jury encompass that possibility as well, not just the finger, but also the face?
The instructions to the jury gave the complete first degree assault, great bodily harm instruction. And I don't disagree with opposing counsel's statement of the law that this court reviews all the entirety of the evidence when deciding a sufficiency of the evidence claim. You know, I think it is significant that this is quite expressly not the theory or the basis that was argued below. And I think it's significant because it illustrates that there is not sufficient evidence. And in fact, there is no evidence of scarring. So to be clear on what the scarring evidence is, it is absolutely correct that there was evidence submitted to the jury that the victim sustained a 2-centimeter laceration on her lip and a 2.5-centimeter laceration on her cheek. That came from the victim's testimony, the ER nurse's testimony, and there are photographs. It is also the case, and I don't think this is cited in the state's brief, but in candor to the court, there is an exhibit. It's exhibit 53 that is a picture of the victim taken the next day, and it shows sutures on those 2 lacerations on her face. And it is in fact correct that I think if you count them, 1 is 4 and 1 is 5. There is no evidence of scarring. The word scar or any of its variations does not arise at all in the victim's testimony. No medical personnel testified that these types of lacerations tend to result in scarring. There was certainly no testimony that the scars were permanent.
Is there enough, do you suppose, in the ordinary course of nature that you don't need an expert, perhaps, if there's evidence of a laceration to the face? Or is your view that you need evidence of an actual scar, or that this will likely result in a scar?
You need evidence. I think that's really undisputed. Every single scarring case that I have found, and I cited a number of them in my brief, the summation of the evidence by the reviewing court is the surgeon testified this type of laceration would result in a permanent scar. The victim testified he had a permanent scar. I mean, I don't particularly know, and I'm a pretty, I think, smart person. I don't know that these lacerations would necessarily result in permanent scarring. So absolutely, I think there is simply not enough evidence. Let me ask this.
Assuming for the sake, just hypothetically, if there had been evidence, or if we thought that there's enough for the jury to infer a permanent scar, would you agree? I mean, you've got, the question is whether it's serious permanent disfigurement. Would you agree that, I don't want to be necessarily gender specific, but I think it probably does matter more. I think can a jury consider the fact that a scar on a woman's face, if it's permanent, is a form of disfigurement, and it's necessarily serious, even if it's small?
No, I'm uncomfortable with that sort of a gender-based assumption.
Well, let's make it non-gender-based. Let's say anyone who's concerned about his or her appearance.
You know, I think that where I would shift the focus is not from necessarily a subjective description of whether a particular victim cares about her or his appearance, but is this prominent? And I think that's where a scar on a face maybe is more prominent than a scar on your back. And that's sort of reflected in the case law. But again, this case would be different if the victim said, I have this big scar on my face and it bothers me, or I have a scar on my face and it's 3 centimeters long. I think I would have a much more difficult case if there was evidence that there was a scar, it was prominent on her face, and it would be permanent. There is no such evidence in this case.
Ms. Bond?
Yes.
So of the 4 alternatives in the definition, you're emphasizing the 3rd one, or permanent or protracted loss of or impairment of the function of any bodily member. In the 2nd clause about serious permanent disfigurement, there's the word serious as an adjective at the beginning of that. But that word does not appear in the 3rd clause, nor is there any other similar adjective about serious or severe or anything like that. So in other words, but I feel like you're asking us to sort of inject that concept into the 3rd clause. But I mean, because if we just look at the words of the statute in the 3rd clause, is there an impairment of the function of any bodily member or organ? And it seems like the member or organ is the index finger. The function is the sense of touch. and there is an impairment of that. I mean, why should we disregard any of those elements, those words in that third clause, and say that the evidence doesn't satisfy that standard?
Couple of reasons, Your Honor. Number one, there is clear case law that all of these subparts of this definition have to be interpreted and applied with consideration of the other parts. So I think this court has to keep in mind that we are talking about the most severe kind of injury that we have under the law. And so there is that component of it has to be a kind of impairment that rises to the level to meet this broader definition of great bodily harm. Number two, I think all of the cases, every single case that I can find, is very clear that when the court is applying that permanent or protracted loss or impairment of a function of a bodily member, what we look at is there evidence that the impairment of the functioning of the member actually impaired the daily activities or some, again, activity that the victim is doing. And there's a lot of good examples in the case law of that the avid canoer can no longer canoe, and the teeth, you can no longer bite or chew. And this case would be different. It's why I think the fact, and I know I'm out of time, if I could answer, just yeah, finish continue. Up. This case would be different. It's why the non-dominant hand, I think, is significant, because if this were the dominant hand, for instance, and the victim testified that lack of sensation in the tip of my index finger means I can't grip a pen and I can't write anymore, that would be a loss or impairment of the function. So I'm not asking the court to inject the word serious into a part of the subdivision where it isn't already there. I am saying that the law requires the court to consider the entirety of the definition, and the case law applying that permanent or protracted require evidence from the victim of some way in which their activities have been impaired, the functioning of this member have been impaired. And there is no such testimony from the victim in this case.
And can you be specific about the case law supporting that point about activities? I think Gerald is probably part of your answer. Are there any others?
I think, yep, Gerald is for sure part of my answer. The Crillo, which is the non-precedential case, the victim testified quite specifically to impairment of, and that was a jaw injury, testified specifically that he was impaired in his ability to talk, to shave, that there were activities that he could not fully do anymore. So I think Gerald and Crillo are the strongest authority.
One more follow-up, if I may, to the first part of your answer about case law emphasizing context. And I haven't studied those carefully. Does that case law, is it concerned with reviewing sufficiency of the evidence, or is the case law concerned with how to instruct the jury?
Definitely more is how to instruct the jury. And I don't have a good answer on the other case, and maybe I could try to look into that while during respondents' argument. And the case law, I think, candidly does that discussion is more focused on the fourth part of the definition, other serious bodily harm. But I think it is relevant to this permanent or protracted loss. And as I said in the brief, you know, if this court affirms here, it is going to be, I would submit, extremely difficult to see any daylight between a first degree assault and a third degree assault. And that is something that the Minnesota Supreme Court has emphasized. That distinction has to be kept clear.
Although your time has expired, if I may, Judge Johnson, follow up with one more question, Ms. Bond. So let's assume hypothetically that we decide not to reverse on grounds of speedy trial right being violated, but adopt your view of the sufficiency of the evidence. There was no third degree option presented to the jury in this case. What would be the result?
That is true. The result would be reverse on the first degree assault and then remand for resentencing on the pattern of stalking conduct. I don't fully understand, given the way the evidence came in, why there wasn't a lesser submitted to the jury, but the fact remains that there wasn't. The jury was not asked, given the definition of substantial bodily harm, did not make any findings on that, and this court cannot then substitute its judgment on that and impose a conviction on something that was not found by the jury.
Of course, we're stuck with the law, but that would be a troubling outcome, wouldn't it, as a matter of practicality in this case when the facts are so clear?
You know, I actually thought about that question. And I would say no. I mean, the prosecutor exercises discretion in its charging decisions. And I would say, I have thought a lot about how this case was charged out. I think the jury came to the correct result in acquitting on attempted murder. And I think the way the evidence came in, there should have been a lesser included. And if the state does not prove every element of the offense on the charges that it chooses to bring, then reversing for a review in court is due process. That is what is required. That is justice.
And there's plenty of case law, at least on the murder and second degree murder cases, to support that. But I was just curious because I didn't see any, I didn't see much of an option, but thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bond. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal, of course. Counsel for respondent, you may introduce yourself and your client and begin your argument.
May it please the court. My name is Todd Zettler. I represent respondent, state of Minnesota. I'll largely focus my argument on the two issues raised in appellant's primary brief. I know there was a late pro se supplemental brief. I filed a response to that, and I'll rely on just the written response unless the court has questions in particular on the pro se aspect of it. In regards to the two primary legal issues raised by appellant in their primary brief, they're essentially making an argument that would have been made to the jury, that the evidence doesn't prove it, but the evidence, in fact, did prove it. So the jury was presented with...
Before you get to the... I'd like to talk about speedy trial for just a moment. I was expecting to see the state's argument about the presumption of prejudice, and I didn't see the word presumption anywhere in the state's brief, and it surprised me because we've got plenty of case law that refers to a presumption that occurs under circumstances like this, a presumption of prejudice. And Mikkel seems to emphasize it even more than some of the earlier cases. Your brief argues that because there was no evidence offered to show that his defense was impaired, that therefore there's a loss on that factor. And I'm not sure the case law supports that.
And I understand your question, Judge Ross. And I can tell you that case law is consistent in the way that it handles prejudice and that it is measured as a factor. It's not just presumed prejudice. If it was, it wouldn't be this multi-factor test. We wouldn't see prejudice as an element. It would simply be presumed, and it's not. And it's looked at in three sub-factors, which are mentioned in...
Well, then what is meant by the presumption of prejudice, then, in the case law? What exactly does that mean?
In terms of the first element or in terms of the fourth?
In terms of the fourth. Doesn't Mikkel present that as part of the fourth element?
And, you know, it isn't clear to me exactly how the court comes to that, because it then goes on and looks at, is there prejudice? And if so, what kind? And it specifically looks at, are we just looking at pre-trial anxiety? Are we looking at an actual impairment of a defense? And the most important is the actual impairment of a defense. And there is no evidence of that or claim of that in this case. Furthermore, this defendant was in custody on other cases almost the entire time, either on the previous second degree assault that he was in custody.
Well, you say almost the entire time, but isn't Ms. Bond correct that in the middle of January that independent incarceration period ended?
I'm not sure if that was the time period that it ended, because he then had a new one that came into effect when he was charged with felony witness tampering for further contact and threatening the victim in this case. So there were a number of other cases that he was in custody on while this was going on. And again, there's no evidence whatsoever of actual prejudice to any defense. And so that's why I treated it that way in the brief. So the courts are consistent that it is an actual factor that is looked at. It's not just assumed. It's treated consistently that way. And there was no actual prejudice to any defense in this case. As to an appellant calls it a new theory on appeal, it's not a new theory on appeal that under the standard of review for sufficiency of the evidence, this court looks at all the evidence. And this court is not bound by any argument made by the prosecution. The court is bound to do a painstaking review of the evidence and looking at it in the light most favorable to the state.
I think you're right. What then is the evidence of a permanent scar on the victim's face?
Her testimony. She testified and showed her face to the jury. And I cite in my brief exactly where that happens. So I can tell you that the state argued facial cuts and stitches in their opening argument. She testified.
I saw the argument about cuts and stitches, but my question goes to, I don't think it's inconceivable for members of the jury or the public to be aware that individuals have operations on their face. They may have a mole removed. They may have stitches for a while, and then surprisingly, no scar left. I mean, is it enough to say that she had stitches and that she was cut? Why isn't there a need to at least make the argument or present some evidence that these stitches or the cuts are likely to lead to permanent scarring?
So, I mean, two things. The defense could have argued that at trial and didn't. So based on the standard of review,
why would the defense need to make the, I mean, we have to look to see if there's evidence in the record from which a jury could reasonably, not speculatively, but reasonably infer that the scars are permanent, or that there would be scars at all, and that if so, that they'd be permanent. Isn't that our standard of review?
It is. Viewed in the light most favorable to the state, this victim took the stand, testified about cuts to her face, and showed her face to the jury. In the light most favorable to the verdict, that supports the verdict.
How does that support a conclusion of permanent disfigurement to her face?
Because first of all, there's cuts to the face, stitches to the face, argued to the jury, shown to the jury. That supports the verdict. I mean, I'm unaware of any facial cuts that wouldn't be permanent, any facial scarring that wouldn't be permanent.
But there's no record of, you're correct that we can assume that the jurors saw her face, but we don't know exactly from what distance and so on. But we also don't know what they saw. I mean, there's no record of that, right? I mean,
there is actually a record of that.
Okay, could you please explain?
When the victim testified, she was specifically asked about the cuts and the facial scarring. And she specifically showed those to, and I'm trying to find it here, to the jurors. She was asked, and the record indicates that she showed and was indicating where she was cut and where the scars were. That's the record. Multiple times that happened.
So the words, now Ms. Bond says the word scar doesn't appear in the transcript. Now I haven't gone and done a word search. It's something we can do relatively easily. Were you able to find the word scar appear either in the closing argument or in the testimony about the lacerations to the face?
No, there was not testimony of scarring. There was testimony of the cuts, and she showed her face to the jury based on the standard of review. So, I mean, based on the standard of review in the light most favorable to the verdict, that supports the verdict. Now, you could go back and argue, well, if it wasn't there, the defense could have said this or could have said that, should have done this or should have done that. But that wasn't the defense. The defense never challenged whether there was.
Well, in fairness, I mean, you're saying the defense never made the argument that there wasn't scarring, but if there was never any evidence that there was a scar, what would be the point of the defense bringing it up?
That there was not.
What are they responding to?
That there was not substantial bodily harm. Look at her face. There's no scarring. There's no substantial bodily harm. There's no great bodily harm. And that would have been the defense argument, and it wasn't. So here we have a witness, a victim, on the stand showing her face to the jury. That's the evidence that we have on review. You then put that through, of course, the standard of review. And the standard of review is in the light most favorable to the verdict. So it's not a question of backing it up to, is it sufficient back then to convince a jury? It's the jury has been convinced. Now, the standard of review later is, in the light most favorable to the verdict, does that support it? And yes, it does.
Were you able to find any case in Minnesota when the sufficiency of the evidence was challenged on this element of great bodily harm, where the conviction was affirmed with this amount of injury or less?
This amount, and so that's the problem with looking at any case law and comparing it to specific breakdown of injury, is there's always a constellation of injuries. So no, I would not be able to find and have not found a case where there is, you know, 5 stitches in this location plus 4 stitches in that location plus the injury to the finger.
What case were you able to find that was closest to this one? I mean, you know, the defense, it's clear here. It's these are not major injuries. These are relatively minor injuries. Were you able to find a case where the injuries were, you mentioned constellation, were somewhat in the nature of these types of injuries, a scar, a 2-centimeter, let's say, scar on the face and a loss of sensitivity in the tip of a finger?
No. I mean, the two cases that I cited were Little Wolf and Bernal on page 14 of my brief. Those support the jury's determination in this case, but it's a jury question as to whether the injury satisfies the great bodily harm element.
And it's a jury question, but you know, you've seen the case law. We still analyze whether the evidence was enough to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that that element's met based upon the legal definition of great bodily harm, right?
True. And again, in this case, that's just one element. This is just one thing, one part of the injuries that we have are the scars to the face. You also have the permanent injury to the finger, which is sufficient in and of itself. You also have over a month of not being able to use her hand, which in and of itself is protracted injury. So there was a constellation of significant serious injuries and impact from this assault that satisfies the great bodily harm element.
Can you give us a definition of protracted that we could say is can be applied universally?
No, I can't, other than what has already been given in Court of Appeals opinions, which is, you know, already cited and discussed. But it's, again, left for the jury. And a month is significant. It's not a day or a week. Over a month of having no use of an arm is significant and protracted.
As far as sufficiency of the evidence, what do you feel is your strongest argument, the scarring or the loss of impairment?
All of it. So the no use for over a month, the facial scarring, the permanent loss of feeling in her finger, all of it put together. Any one alone is sufficient, but all of it together is the strongest, obviously.
With respect to her loss of sense of touch in her finger, was there any evidence or any testimony by her about daily activities of life that were affected by that condition?
Yes. She was unable to have any feeling of temperature, so that was a problem for her. She was unable to feel buttons, so she wasn't able to put shirts on or off easily. She had 2 young children that she was caring for, which was a continuing difficulty for her. There was testimony about that presented to the jury as well.
I guess, I think the argument by appellant based on Gerald is that there's a distinction between the function of a bodily member or organ, and then some activity of life that is affected by that loss of function. I mean, Gerald talks about hearing, chewing, eating, and breathing. In this case, it sounds like, you know, from your answer, I can see dressing oneself is something she had difficulty with. But so thinking about it that way, is there any other activity of her life that, you know, that she previously engaged in, but is now unable to engage in because of this loss of sense in her finger?
The only testimony at trial of how that would impact her or had impacted her to date was the inability to feel, inability to do buttons, inability to feel heat and continued pain from that going forward.
Was it the inability to manipulate buttons with that finger or entirely?
I don't recall in what way that came in, Judge. I don't know the answer to that.
I mean, it would seem unusual, I guess, if you lost sensation in one finger that would prohibit you from being able to, I can think of two, I mean, maybe three fingers, but I'm just trying to think of, in my mind, I'm trying to think, how do I, you just do it. I don't know exactly how I manipulate my hands to button a shirt, but it seems to me that if it was only while she was in the healing process until she got the fullness of whatever recovery she's going to get to, or it's just that she can't manipulate a button with that finger, I don't know that is a very, at least significant impact on an activity, if she can still actually perform the activity.
Well, and I would say that the testimony is that it's likely going to be a permanent loss, and that her testimony a year later was that it was gone.
Right. I think that's clear. As to the sensation, my point or my question was just getting at, in response to Judge Johnson's questions about life activity, you mentioned buttoning clothes. And I just wanted to get a sense of whether it was her testimony was she couldn't use that finger to button to use that hand to button.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the end of the question, Judge.
Whether she was able to use the hand as opposed to at all to button, or whether it was just that she had to use something other. In other words, did she have some other means to button her clothes using the finger on the opposite side of the one that was injured?
I don't think that the focus of the trial was on her ability to button a shirt or not. I think that was just mentioned as one of the issues that she was having going forward. Unless there are
go ahead. You may sum up, Mr. Zettler.
Unless there are any other questions, I would simply ask this court to affirm the district court in its entirety.
Thank you for your argument, Mr. Zettler. Ms. Bond, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. As to the buttoning and the protracted issue, I would refer the court to my brief where I try to set out that we've got two periods of time going on. We've got what I referred to as the month of the post-op time period. And that is when the victim is testifying that she had the problem doing things like lifting her children, buttoning her clothes. I read her testimony as saying that was not so much because of the loss of nerve sensation in the tip of the finger, but because the tendon in the finger was still healing and the entire hand was still bandaged. So if we are talking about any of the impairments, I will use that word, in the post-op period, the argument why those are not sufficient to affirm a first-degree assault conviction is it because they're not prolonged. And that time period is actually on all fours with this court's Galle, G-A-L-L-E opinion. It is non-precedential. It's very helpful because in that opinion, this court says very clearly that a 4 to 6 week time period of recovery is not protracted within the meaning of the first degree assault statute and the definition of great bodily harm. So that's why those injuries that the victim testified to in that initial, say, 4 to 5 weeks are not sufficient to be great bodily harm. At the time she's at the trial and talking about what her current impairments are, she is only talking about her finger. So I want the, you know, I urge the court to look, her testimony is pretty quick on this, and the court can see pretty clearly, I think, to what extent she is talking about any injury at the time of trial, and it is only those injuries or impairments that might qualify as permanent or protracted. There's a lot of talk about the scarring. The things I would refer the court to is her, the victim's testimony at page 303 of the transcript, because that is where she is asked to show where her lacerations are. That is the only, I mean, the jury clearly saw her testify, but counsel's argument about she showed the scars or she showed the injuries to the jury. On page 303 of the transcripts, it is very specifically about what injuries did you have at the time? Where were the cuts on your face? That is what she is showing to the jury. The other very helpful case, I think, for this court is Dye.
Can we infer from the fact that there was something to show? Were there still stitches or were the stitches out by then?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I assume that they're out, but she didn't testify to that.
If we assume that they're out and she pointed to something, were you saying this, she just pointed to some, a location on her face, not a mark on her face? Is there any indication that that's so, or one way or the other?
There is no, the testimony is, so you talked about how you had some cuts on your face. This is page 303. What kind of injuries did you have on your face after the assault? And then her answer is, on my mouth, I had a deep cut. And then on the side of my face, I had a cut. And the prosecutor says, just to clarify, you pointed here and here. And she said, yes. So that is very expressly talking about the injuries that she sustained in the form of the lacerations. There was no question and no testimony of, then I got the stitches out, now I have scars, nothing like that. And I mean, the state, I think, knows how to elicit that testimony. We see it in a lot of the cases very clearly that someone testifies that they have a scar, or a medical professional testifies that looking at the lacerations at the time they were, at the time they occurred and the number of stitches that were used, these are the kind of lacerations that will result in permanent scarring. Nothing like that. And the Dye case is helpful on this scarring point, because it did very specifically reject any argument that serious permanent disfigurement was present in that case. And it said whether there was permanent scarring is unknown because no one testified to it. And the state's case of Little Wolf that cited in its brief and that it counsel just referred to, in that case, that the plastic surgeon testified that permanent scarring would result. We don't have that here. So there's no basis for affirming based on the scarring. I'm out of time. I would just refer on the speedy trial issue that the district court did issue an order, and particularly on that prejudice prong, as far as whether whether appellant could have been released on after that January 14th, 2021 date, is addressed in the court's order. And that, I think, is helpful.
I assume you agree with Mr. Zettler, though, that if we look to the record, we won't find any actual prejudice found. I mean, there's no evidence of prejudice presented.
I do not agree with that. Both in the January 14th hearing and in the appellant's pro se motion to dismiss his case, he talks about having a job waiting, having employment waiting. So there's nothing in the record that shows prejudice to the case and his ability to defend the case.
No prejudice to the defense, I guess that's what I meant.
I think there's no, under that third prong, there is not anything specific that I could point the court to. But those first two prongs of prejudice, in oppressive incarceration and anxiety, those are triggered once we pass that January 14th date, in particular, given the motion to dismiss that was filed by my client. For those reasons, I would ask this court to reverse both convictions for speedy trial violation, or alternatively reverse the first degree assault conviction for lack of evidence and remand for resentencing on the pattern of stalking conduct. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bond.